I'm Brooks Brunson.
I'm Emery Parker.
And we're here yet again to explain the forces shaping the Palmetto State.
Sorry.
You want to say it?
No.
Do you want to say it?
Like,
this is Understand South Carolina. Sorry, it's just really fun to say.
It's fun to say.
It's like the NPR newscast. I digress. Okay. So before we get started, a few housekeeping notes real quick. Emery and I want to say that we're so sorry.
We are sorry.
We really are. So Emery and I think we mentioned this sometimes because we love to complain. No, just kidding. in addition to this podcast, we have full-time and sometimes more than full-time jobs as digital editors for the Post and Courier. And a whole lot of just stuff has come up these last few weeks, which is why this is our first episode after a two-week hiatus. We're really sorry. And to kind of help keep this from happening moving forward, we are going to be releasing episodes on a bi-weekly basis instead of weekly.
Yeah, I mean, like when we launched the show, we really didn't know what to expect. And it has been great to see the show just like really take off. And it's really exceeded, I think, our wildest expectations.
Yeah, like I'm like, whoa, this many people want to listen to
me?
Really?
Yeah, and we've gotten so much great feedback since we launched it. Like it's great to hear from y'all. But I think we really want to keep the show at the quality that y'all expect. And so that's why we're going to make this change. It's maybe not permanent, but at least for now.
Yeah, because we didn't want to phone in episodes, which just cranking them out. But, you know, sometimes the quality is not as good if we're doing that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what we're going to be doing, at least for the rest of this year. Anyway, now back onto normal business. So today we have political reporter Caitlin Bird.
Hey, guys. You're getting a two-for-one special today to make up for the two-week hiatus.
We really are. She's been on the show with us twice before, so this is your third appearance here on Understand SC. Caitlin's episode on Mark Sanford was actually one of our most popular.
And that thing took off.
It really did, yeah. So she's here to continue that conversation and talk more about South Carolina's role in electing the president of the United States. Welcome back, Caitlin.
Thank you.
So we're also joined by, Skylar is your boss.
Oh, yeah. He's my boss.
Caitlin's boss is here, is our political editor, Skylar Croft. And Skylar, how long have you been covering South Carolina politics?
I was hired on December 7th, 1987, and I have covered some facet of South Carolina politics since that minute. So
that exact moment in time.
Everything about South Carolina's politics.
I love how you know the exact date. Since Skylar is kind of an expert who can obviously knows his stuff, gosh, 87, is that 32 years ago?
I forget.
Yeah, 32 years ago.
I gave you two bonus years in the trenches.
So I kind of thought you could start us off by answering a really broad and potentially difficult question. Describe just like in a nutshell, like what do you think South Carolina's role exactly is in electing the president of the United States?
I think you want to go back in time. South Carolina really emerged in the primary process about 1980. And it's really the brainchild of our former governor, Congressman Carroll Campbell, and former South Carolina-born strategist Lee Atwater, who saw what was going on in the South was changing from Democrats to Republicans. And they wanted to get a piece of picking the president, so they worked together to make South Carolina a higher profile in 1980, so we could become a player. And that year,
so what do you mean by shifting from Democrats to Republicans? For the listeners who might not be familiar,
traditionally the South was white Democrats. They controlled everything. There was no need to have a Republican primary because white Democrats controlled everything. But you saw the Southern strategy happen around the time of Richard Nixon and such, when things started shifting down and the Bible-related voter started becoming a real power player and what happened. And people got upset with the Democratic Party. The black vote was going and trying to find a space in the Democratic Party. And you just saw a complete exodus in that direction. So the power base of the country just began to shift from the East to the South.
Hmm. Wow, it's really weird to think that it goes all the way back that far. And I mean, I guess like were the policies of the did the policies of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party kind of shift with that? I mean, I guess it's hard for me to imagine like the majority of the South holding Democratic ideals.
Yeah, you know, who was the poor man's party? Was the Democrats, and that kind of shifted, and you know, the Democrats became the party of unions and hippies and that sort of thing too, and the white middle class, the working folk, were looking for a place to go, and then the Republicans kind of put the bait out and said, "Come with us."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of famous names now that we think about, like Strom Thurmond, was a Democrat.
Really?
For a really long time. He eventually did switch to...
Yeah, he...
Yeah, I can't even imagine. He was a
Democrat because we were everyone in South Carolina was a Democrat. Yeah. So that was his party. And then remember, he became a Dixiecrat, which became, you know, kind of the Southern race party and represented the 11 Southern states in the South. And when he ran for president, that was 1948. And again, in the 60s, he started becoming a Republican, and he was... very, very good friends with Richard Nixon, and you know, rejecting the politics of Kennedy. So it was off in that direction.
Well, I guess though, what I'm curious is, so then how does this lead us to the situation that we have now, where South Carolina has this really early presidential primary?
Well, I mean, you go back to 1980. Then if you become fourth in the process, and you are a state of white evangelicals that were, you know, the big tent that was being opened at that time to let them in, South Carolina is you know, the buckle of the Bible Belt. So it became the perfect state to come down and test your Republican credentials. And that's what happened around that time. Mm-hmm. And that primary drew out Ronald Reagan, who again was the first to open the door to the evangelicals against John Connally from Texas. And it became Ronald Reagan's show. I mean, basically South Carolina was one of the states that gave him the bounce.
So that kind of brings us to where we are at today, right? South Carolina is now, it's one of the early primary states, and that's for both parties, correct?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
First in the South.
With the very first in the South, right? So it's kind of interesting, yeah, that, you know, that's kind of the background of why we became the first. And this 2020 election, as y'all know, Caitlin broke the story last week that the South Carolina Republican Party is actually getting sued because they canceled the Republican primary here, kind of meaning that South Carolina would... I guess that's a good question. Does that mean that South Carolina automatically goes Trump in the prime as the Republican nominee officially?
Well, right now, we're because of this pending litigation, we still have to see what's going to happen. So the Republican Party in South Carolina has about 30 days to respond to the lawsuit that was filed on October 1st. And it's really important to note that the plaintiffs of that case include a former Republican congressman from South Carolina, Bob Inglis, who has spoken out against President Trump in the past.
Right. I remember there was a story in June 2017, kind of around the Comey hearings, or maybe shortly thereafter, and when some stuff was really coming out about Trump, because Inglis had voted to impeach Clinton. And then he said it was a quote, something like the Clinton impeachment now seems far less consequential than the idea of impeaching Trump. So, yeah, that context is really interesting.
Right. And so basically some of the Republicans who were upset by this decision by the Republican Party's executive committee here in South Carolina was they argue that their vote is now effectively neutered because they have no place to take their vote during the primary when there are, in fact, Republican challengers running against Donald Trump, Mark Sanford, Joe Walsh, and Bill Weld, at least right now. But without that primary, there's really no way to gauge how they would do here. And that's important, as we talked about in the last time I was here, about, you know, Mark Sanford running for office, the highest office, is that the South Carolina Republican primary in particular holds a lot of political weight because Republicans here have picked every eventual Republican presidential nominee with the exception of 2012 and Newt Gingrich. So without that data point, is really kind of, for some Republicans, a glaring omission of South Carolina's participation in the process. But to other Republicans, why spend the money, why waste the time when they know that the outcome is going to be heavily Trump?
Yeah.
There was a poll earlier this year that found more than 90% of Republicans here, if the primary were held today, they would vote for Donald Trump.
Yeah, so I feel like that's kind of the obvious question. And we got into this a little bit in the Mark Sanford episode, but I guess if they were to hold a primary, Trump is all but certain to win it. So what would be the point of running a primary? Like, if you're opposed to Trump, what would that point be?
I think the point for Republicans who are opposed to Trump and who want an alternative is, part of it is they don't want to feel like outliers. And to them, they don't think that they're outliers, right? Because everybody goes and retreats to their own collective echo chambers. And so right now, the Republican echo chamber is Trump, 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 Trump. But there are parts of the Republican Party, though not as vocal, not as loud, not as large, that are saying, I don't know if Trump is the right nominee for us as a party moving forward. What happens to the brand of the Republican Party after 2020? Mm-hmm. What happens in 2024?
Yeah.
So that's kind of part of the question. And then with this lawsuit in particular, the plaintiffs are arguing that the state Republican Party broke their own rules when they made this decision. So that's kind of the tricky ins and outs. My guess is that the Republican Party is going to wait until the very last minute to respond to this, because they did have lawyers consulting on this decision made by the executive committee. But that decision was not unanimous.
Mm-hmm. I do just want to ask, though, I think what to follow up on Brooks's question, though. So obviously, yeah, we're going to wait and see what does end up happening. But before this lawsuit was filed, what just to be specific, like what actually would the process is Brooks right that they would just nominate Trump? Is that would the party just have that ability if they didn't have a primary? Is that
I think you really need to go back and understand what the purpose of a primary is. It's where. For a lot of people, it's the only time your vote will ever count.
Yeah.
Because districts are so skewed in this state. You know the outcome of what the party is going to win. You know what the November race is going to look like already. So it's really—
Right. We're going to go red in the November race.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's a really important point to make. I've lived here in South Carolina, or here in the first district, for a while now. And actually, the Cunningham race was like really, really wild, because even though he did end up winning, like most people didn't even think it was a competitive race. Even on the national scale, there were no like polls. It really came out of nowhere. And yeah, every year that we've had an election, it's always been who's going to win the Republican primary, because that's really the race to watch.
Yeah, so, it's just so skewed in that way. And it's also a really good opportunity for people who just never get involved in politics, because this is, you know, you don't have to be a member of the Republican Party to vote in a primary or the Democratic primary. You don't have to go to the meetings. You don't have to give any money. You can just go out and vote, because our primaries are open. So it is an opportunity for a lot of time to make a statement ahead
of
November.
You can't vote in both, though, right?
You can't vote in both. You have to pick one,
but you can choose either one. You don't have to be a Democrat or Republican.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, that breaks the question. I mean— there's a lot I don't know about polling. Maybe you get, and maybe this could be a little bit of a complex thing to unpack. But I mean, you think about 2016. You know, we had all news organizations were pretty much saying like 95%, 98% Hillary Clinton is going to win. We all know what happened there, right? So these Republicans that are saying, okay, like more than 90% of voters in South Carolina are going to go Trump, even if we had one. I mean, do they actually know that? I mean, do we know these polls are accurate?
Well, okay, I do just want to make one point of clarification. I think the numbers you're talking about in 2016, so what a lot of news organizations did, and 538 kind of pioneered this, and it is confusing, but they put out what they call like probabilities.
Okay, so that's a little different than polling.
That's different than polling. Okay. So what they would do is they would look at a poll that said, they would add up all these polls that are like 51%, 49%, you know, if you add up all the polls, then you run a bunch of simulations and then you say like, okay, we're like 90% certain that Hillary's going to win based on the polls. Doesn't mean that
that
the polls said 90% of people are going to vote.
But that's good. I'm confused by it.
Yeah. It is absolutely confusing. And that's like one of the like issues that came out of 2016, is that people felt like there was a poor job of communicating that to people. But I think in this case, what we're talking about, though, is actual polls that say we're not like 90% certain that they would win. We're saying like actually 90% of the voters would vote in this way.
But how did they get that information, I guess?
You extrapolate out, and every poll has a margin of area. And you have your universe of X number of thousands of people when you do such a thing. And again, I mean, if you hire a polling company and they give you bad information and things are absolutely wrong, I mean— this is what they do. This is what they do professionally. Versus there's also polling out there that's done to intentionally skew and mislead and that sort of thing. So it you know, where's your faith in whatever company you're using or whatever poll you're using?
Right. And this particular poll that we're talking about is coming from Winthrop University, which is an independent academic institution. And what they try to do is make sure that the sample of their polling is representative of the population at large.
Mm-hmm.
And for a poll, too, I mean— when you vote, you end up on any number of lists. And so if your household or yourself is a traditional Republican household, chances are much better you're going to be surveyed for a poll versus someone who mm-hmm. votes in a Democratic primary is not going to be the object
right,
of a question.
Right, because, I mean, I know I have a family member who traditionally votes in the Democratic primary, but in some cases that family member will vote in the Republican primary because he kind of sees it as, you know, he's a Democrat, but he wants the Republican nominee to be somebody, you know, he's kind of a moderate. So it's mm-hmm. like, he's like a Democrat technically, but like he will vote in the Republican primary to kind of see, like, kind of make it like the candidate that would be the most tolerable. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, that makes a lot of yeah. sense. And I think a lot of people in the state do that because, I mean, if you think about it, if you're a Democrat, it's incredibly unlikely that South Carolina is going to go blue in a presidential election. So whoever the Democratic nominee is, you're probably just going to, like, say you're going to vote for that person. But since you live here in South Carolina, actually, yeah, probably the more influential decision that you could make is to vote in the Republican right. primary, because that's where South Carolina's electoral votes are probably going to end up going.
You also become that unicorn. You right. become desirable by whatever candidate who thinks you're malleable and can go one way, one election, and one way, another. So there is a large segment. And that probably is a group of people that helped Joe Cunningham, the Democrat,
right.
win the congressional district.
Bob Inglis and what was the other guy's name?
Frank Heindel. I hope I said that last name right. He's a voter in Mount Pleasant.
To their point, I guess, you know, like, is there any chance that if we did have a primary that somebody besides Trump could, or at least could somebody get a little bit of traction, if not become the nominee?
I think 2016 should teach all of us that we can't count our chickens before they hatch.
Right.
And that the election is the ultimate determination of how people feel about someone. So when we're talking about the Republican side of things, you're right. Right now, obviously, within the base at large, it is Trump, Trump, Trump. He's the incumbent. This is also precedent for just how things work around here. Skylar can probably rattle off all the years that mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats here in South Carolina have held presidential primaries, and then years when they haven't, because they've had an incumbent president in the White House. So there's some precedent there. But at the same time, when we're talking about these types of long shot bids, the goal, as even some of the candidates have pointed out themselves, may not necessarily be to win the nomination outright, but to shake up the national debate surrounding what the party looks like moving forward.
Yeah.
And if the numbers backed up the rhetorical appeals that they're making to voters, then that might rattle the cages a little bit more than just going and, you know, getting a sandwich at Arby's in New Hampshire. You know, it's just a different thing. Sorry, that was a little bit of an inside joke.
Yeah, but I mean, what I was about to say, and I'm curious if y'all agree with this take, but I feel like the what you would want to accomplish from running a presidential primary if you're a challenger for Trump is not necessarily to win it outright. That's incredibly unlikely, but to overperform your polls. So that is to say that, like, if you could get like 20% of the vote or something like that, that would change the media narrative. You know, for example, in the past couple of weeks, we've been seeing like Democratic fundraising totals come out. And Biden is still on top, but the media narrative really shifted because Elizabeth Warren started to raise a lot of money. Now, she's still in the second place, but the fact that she's overperforming kind of changes the media narrative, gets people talking about it. So I feel like maybe that would be the goal, is not necessarily to win it outright, but to make a splash
get that conversation
yeah. started. You know,
and you gotta realize this: the Republicans running against Trump, it's very cheap to run for president if you have no prayer of a chance.
Yeah, I
mean, and that's and the money you are using is not yours.
Yeah.
So if you don't like President Trump and want to embarrass him, that's your goal, and you can do that by seeking free media, which is what Mark Sanford is doing by appearing on talk shows mm-hmm. and going to Arby's and that kind of stuff.
He had that life-size cutout.
The life-size Trump yeah. cutout that he toted around the state to make a case for the Republicans here in his home state to hold a primary, saying that this would be the only debate that he could have with the president right now.
To sort of follow up, when we talked to Caitlin on our Mark Sanford episode, that was right after she had broke the story that he was exploring possibly running. Since then, he has decided to run. And can you kind of update us? I mean, when we talked last time, it seemed like there was not a lot of Republican support in South Carolina for Sanford. Since he's started, I guess, campaigning a little bit, have you seen that change at all?
It's highly anecdotal, but so far the people that I hear from who are supportive of Mark Sanford and his run are the people who have always been supportive of Mark Sanford and his run.
Right.
The interesting movement, though, since he actually decided to announce, is that he has been actually making the rounds around the country. So he's gone to New Hampshire. He's gone to Iowa. He went and spoke at, in California, which California is a huge delegate state. So that's kind of important if you think about the backdrop behind going and talking about politics in California, that maybe he's crunching the numbers in the back of his head. He is back in South Carolina right now, but he's going to be going back up to New Hampshire because, as he said to his supporters in an email sent last night, he's seeing some traction there potentially among New Hampshire voters who tend to be a little bit more focused on the fiscal and pocketbook issues. So that would be right up Sanford's alley. Yeah. So he's been kind of doing what he's always done, which is, you know, retail politicking, going into restaurants, shaking people's hands, talking in parking lots, going anywhere where he can be heard, even if it means showing up at a festival and getting thrown out because people are like, you can't be soliciting because you don't have a booth. Which did happen to him.
Did that happen?
It did happen to him at like a food festival that he went to in one of the early states. It was either Iowa or New Hampshire. I can't remember which one offhand.
He got thrown out.
He got thrown out and he continued talking to people in like the parking lot.
Oh my gosh.
Very on brand.
That guy knows how to make a splash.
He does. But at the same time, I mean, this is the way that he's always campaigned and he prefers it this way. And to Skylar's point, you know, for someone who is Mark Sanford, who really is focused on the bottom line, he can still be the fiscal conservative and run on the cheap, though he did ask people to give him $10 in his last email. So he's trying to make the fundraising appeal, but kind of on his own terms.
But yeah, to Skylar's point, it was a lot of this might just be to maybe embarrass the president a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And to their point, you know, like, Joe Walsh is a very different Republican than Mark Sanford. He's much more abrasive and he's much more brash in his comments. Part of that is he went from being in Congress to being
Walsh,
a talk show host.
Another one that's running?
Yeah, he's a former Illinois congressman. And they were actually both on CNN's State of the Union this past week. And you could tell just from their approach, they just have very different approaches to how to handle President Trump. So it's going to be interesting. But right now, those conversations really are peripheral for a lot of Republicans. So how much that stays in the periphery and how much that they can actually inject that into the national conversation is going to be something to watch. So we'll just have to wait and see. But when you don't have primaries in early states like South Carolina, that message is a lot harder to get traction because, to Emery's point, you can't – you lose that yardstick.
Mm-hmm.
What you're probably going to see is since Iowa has a caucus, that's open. Mm-hmm. We'll see how Mark does there, but he's really got to persuade – thousands of people to come out and support them, and I just don't know that's going to happen.
What's the difference between a caucus?
A caucus is not a very informal event. You would have voters show up to different places, and there would be a little bit of discussion, and you would say, I vote for candidate A. People in this corner say, I vote for candidate B. Candidate A wins. That's it. So it's just going forward, that sort of thing. It's a very—
And I've just always wondered, like, I feel dumb asking this, but the difference between like the Iowa caucus and South Carolina primary, what you're describing just sounds so unorganized.
Yeah, it is unorganized, but they hold it on a date and someone comes out the winner with percentage of the vote and you go from there. But when you go to New Hampshire, mm-hmm. it's a primary.
Right.
It's an all day, go into the ballot booth, pass, vote.
And the state runs it, not the political parties,
right.
Which is a difference between us and them.
And the caucus, the
political parties run it. Is that what you're saying? Oh, you're saying for New Hampshire?
Between the New Hampshire and us for the primaries.
Gotcha, that makes sense. Yeah.
And so you'll have a primary there, and it's open. I think it's only $1,000 to get on a primary ballot there. So, you know, that's why you get the huge, huge ballots there, people who want to make their name known or their cause known. And I think what you'll see, you know, if South Carolina ends up not having a primary, Mark will be down here just talking on TV cameras wherever he can and trying to steal some thunder for his issue.
So, yeah, that was my other question is, okay, if he there's not a primary in South Carolina, which is his home state, I mean, are voters going to have the chance to vote for him in these other states?
Well, at least four other states have canceled their primaries as well.
Okay.
So the path going forward after here is bleak.
Yeah. So it makes sense then that he's going to be pivoting and turning some of his attention to New Hampshire.
In New Hampshire, he will. Will there be a Republican primary in New Hampshire?
Yes, I reached out to the Treasury Department up there, and they told me yes, we will have one. They haven't put the dates on their website yet, but it's there. He'll just have to pay the money and get on the ballot.
Do you guys remember? I think was it in 2016? There was a kind of a fight between South Carolina and another state that wanted to move their primary up.
I forget what the states were, but everyone seems to do that. I think Iowa and New Hampshire have to go first,
mm-hmm.
and then it's open after that. But the primary dates are also kind of confirmed and set and agreed upon by the state. I'm sorry, by the national parties. So if a state wanted to jump in front of South Carolina for some reason, there would be penalties in terms of delegates. They would delegates cut off, funding, that kind of stuff too. So you know the national parties are the ones that kind of govern the dates now.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious. Have you heard anybody talk about whether or not maybe this kind of sets a precedent though in that regard? The fact that we're just not going to have a primary this year. Do you think that might embolden some other states? Have you heard that at all? Or,
well, I think it goes back to the argument is just, you know, the parties are supposed to support the sitting president.
Right.
So, you know, holding a primary doesn't help a sitting president. It only helps the challenger.
Yeah.
So the mentality, I think, is to, you know.
So states like New Hampshire, it's not the party that's running the primary, so therefore they're going to probably have the primary no matter what. Yeah. But in South Carolina,
if there are candidates, yeah.
Gotcha, that makes sense. Okay.
But right now, I mean, all of the focus on South Carolina is definitely Democrats, which is, to our point earlier, you know, for Democratic voters, this is their chance. You know, they will not have that chance in the general election, potentially.
Well, yeah. I mean, That might be a useful thing to go through.
Yeah,
with
we didn't
people.
Want to talk
so
about
what,
that.
What's the state of play in the South Carolina Democratic primary that we know of so far?
Well, right now, I mean, just in terms of the candidates, Joe Biden has got a pretty strong and consistent lead here in South Carolina.
Yeah.
He has historic ties that go back decades. I mean, he's been in office for decades, and some of those relationships that he's built over the years have been in South Carolina. The thing with the state at large, though, is we go back to order. We're the first in the South. We're the fourth in the lineup on the calendar. But we're the first state where the majority minority voting population is expected to make up those Democratic primary voters. Mm-hmm. And then our date is for the Democrats is going to be on February 29th of 2020. The following Tuesday is not just any Tuesday. It's Super Tuesday, and that gives South Carolina even more of a weight because South Carolina could help set a tone for what then Super Tuesday basically counts for more about 40% of the delegate count for Democrats. So if South Carolina can set a tone, because the other states before South Carolina do not have majority Black Democratic primary voters. Nevada has majority. It'll have a good test in Nevada for Hispanic voters. But Iowa and New Hampshire are heavily white,
mm-hmm.
and South Carolina is more representative of Democratic voters as a whole nationwide. So South Carolina, in its own little litmus test way, is going to be really important. And like I said, it's almost like that Saturday, of that South Carolina Saturday, could really translate to Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
So I know that we had a lot of Democratic candidates here this weekend. Both Skylar and Caitlin, by the way, have been working nonstop. They've been participating in the Post and Courier's Pints and Politics events, which we'll touch on at the end of the episode. But I mean, was Biden here this week? He was not
here this week.
So what did you guys, I mean, there was the Blue Jamboree?
I was at the Charleston County Democratic Party's Blue Jamboree. It's their biggest kind of annual fundraiser. This year they had more than 3,000 tickets sold, which was a record for them because all of those tickets go to support the party. And then the party can use those funds to help in races like South Carolina's first congressional district to help with smaller races too and really just do party building, reaching out to folks and building their voter rolls and things like that. But yeah, this weekend the top tier, the highest tier candidate that got to address Charleston County Democrats directly was Senator Kamala Harris. Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden, who have been kind of the top tier candidates thus far. Also, Pete Buttigieg, you could throw him in there kind of in the mix since he's gaining some ground. They were not there, but I think—
Why were they not here if this is such an important—
Well, we're only – well, I mean, part of it is, one, like, you have to look at the schedules of the campaigns. Right. That's part of it. And there may be more important South Carolina Democratic events that they would want to be seen at, which they did do. So we're talking about, like, the Clyburn Fish Fry. If you weren't at the Fish Fry – you weren't running. Right. So everyone came to the Fish Fry. Everyone came to the South Carolina Democratic Party Convention. And also those are statewide. Those are for all Democrats. So and in some ways, they got to think about bang for their buck.
Right.
So
this one this weekend was the Lowcountry specifically.
Right. Lowcountry specifically. And again, you kind of have to look at the schedule of the candidates, because once Kamala was done with the Blue Jamboree, she then went to Beaufort and had a town hall.
Yeah.
So you kind of do a couple, they do a couple of swings. You know, usually they don't just come down for one and go. Usually there's at least two or three, if not five, events that they try to check off their list or have private meetings with people or roundtables, things like that. So this weekend was really kind of a rallying call for the Charleston County Democrats to get excited, to kind of take this energy into the 2020 election, to hear directly from candidates that maybe they haven't heard of much beforehand outside of maybe some of them who have qualified for the debate stage. So, you know, they each got 20 minutes to make a pitch. Some of them used all of their time. Some of them did not. It was interesting. There were seven candidates total who spoke.
Mm-hmm.
So, Skylar, you might be able to touch a little bit more on this. So we talked about earlier, like, historically, when South Carolina has a Republican primary, that is usually the nominee. What about for the Democratic primary? Is that the same, or is it a little bit different?
It's a little bit different in that you're just not getting the big numbers. This is kind of the biggest field of Democrats I've seen, but... who knows if they're going to be standing by the time February rolls around. You had X number of people running in when Hillary and Bernie right. ran last time, and it turned out to be a two-person show. So it depends on who's standing at that time. But I went and pulled some numbers. I think like to illustrate your point on where we stand is in 2016, you had 740,000 people vote in the Republican primary. You only had 370,000 in the Democratic primary.
Oh, wow.
And so you're looking at 2-1.
Right.
The Democrats had two candidates, basically, and the Republicans had 10 or so. So
so we don't really hold as much of a, like, deciding about who's going to be the nominee, which makes sense because we're not really mostly Democratic state. Just because we're such an early primary, though, I wondered if that translated.
What I was about to say when you were asking your question a second ago, though, I think that, and this is true for all of the early primaries, the real dividend from them is narrative, is media right. attention. I mean, because what's going to happen, like to what Caitlin was talking about, is you have these early primaries, and that gives the media like a story, something to talk about. Somebody has won New Hampshire, somebody has won South Carolina, they have momentum, right? Going into these big days like Super Tuesday. So, like, if you're a candidate, I think it makes a lot of sense. You're going to spend your time trying to get the victory that you can get. So, like, if you're competitive in New Hampshire, you know, you want to win that New Hampshire victory. I remember in 2008, the thing that, like, really helped Obama was when he won the Iowa caucus, right? That kind of cemented this media narrative, like, okay, now he's, before that people were wondering, is he electable? Will white people vote for him? And then Iowa is this, like, you know, majority white state. Obama wins it. It creates this media narrative. He's got momentum now, right? So I think it does kind of make sense, though, that you're not maybe seeing as many people down here in South Carolina right now, just because we do see Biden with a pretty sizable lead right now. So you've got to kind of play to where your strengths are. And I don't know who feels like they've got a shot at, like, chipping away at Biden's lead down here, you know?
Yeah, I guess you want to play with your geography. I mean, the field will drop significantly after Iowa and again after New Hampshire, and we'll see who's standing here. But again, if you look like a Bernie Sanders, he got thumped here in 4 years ago. Didn't look good for him at all. Even he left the state early and wasn't even here on election day. So
that's right. He's like, I'm over it.
So he saw what was going to happen, and then he went out west. But you know, no matter what happens to Bernie Sanders, he's got staying power. So he could lose Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, and would still have plenty of followers and money in another part of the country. So you might see some of that.
It's entirely possible that, and I would say right now it looks likely that there might be like a different winner for each early primary state. You know, and then each one of them will claim to have momentum based on who has, you know, which races they've won.
So do we kind of see like people like Bernie Sanders like giving South Carolina less attention are going into it?
This time Bernie's giving South Carolina much more attention.
Oh, he is. Okay.
He has definitely, he learned from seeing that writing on the wall last time, and he's been spending much more time with folks down here because he knows how important South Carolina can be because it was important last time. We see people like Kamala Harris especially saying that she thinks that she can do really well here, especially among black women. And that makes a lot of sense considering she herself is a woman of color. What's really interesting is seeing how there's always this like invisible presence in the room, though, of Joe Biden. Even if Joe Biden isn't in the room, all of these candidates are having to figure out how to contend with him because he just looms everywhere. He's the de facto candidate for a lot of folks around here. But it's going to be really interesting just to see how it shakes out. And I think part of it is just as the field thins, that's going to be really telling. And it, from talking anecdotally with voters over the weekend, a lot of folks have been very frustrated by the debate process because they too thought that it might help thin the herd and that it might get some candidates out of the running and then give other candidates more time to make a pitch. And instead, you know, the field is still at 19. That's a lot. That's a lot of people for voters to consider.
It's like a heavy decision. Like, I'm like the most indecisive person, so I can't, 19. You know, like, I feel like most voters must be kind of
and they're all on the same
paralyzed.
Side, right?
Like, yeah, like, I don't know, like, which one, you
so
know?
And think about it. If you want to use, like, a sports analogy, everybody's got the same jersey on, but everyone wants to be captain.
Yeah.
It's really, really hard. It's really hard, and it's tough to, like, get into the nuances, especially this early. So it's hard.
Okay,
real quick note-wise, I think there was only one thing I wanted to ask about, which is I want to get in just kind of wrap up with the impeachment stuff. But
we can go ahead and segue.
Yeah, we're up to 40 minutes, so I think that can be like the thing that we kind of close it out on, all right?
Yeah.
All right, so the last thing that I wanted to talk about is kind of the elephant in the room, or is more like, I guess, kind of the Kool-Aid man that burst into the room in the last minute, which is this impeachment inquiry that we had no clue that this was going to happen when we were last in here talking about this stuff. Do we have any sense on how this might play into what ends up happening? I mean, I'm just kind of imagining, like, what happens if a president gets impeached and then we don't have a primary? Like, what?
Oh, that's a really good, I did not think about that, but yeah.
I mean, it's incredibly unlikely. It's unlikely. I'm not saying that's going to happen. But
if it did, and then we don't have, yeah.
What do we think about this? Like, is this possible or what?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he would assume his role and continue his role as the president until the Senate votes to remove him.
Yeah.
But if we haven't held a primary, I mean, I don't know what the timeline would kind of be. I mean, would there then...
Mike Pence would assume the duties and he would be the de facto party nominee and assume all the rights and duties thereof.
Hmm.
Wow.
That would really be wild.
I might have asked Caitlin this last time, but I can't quite remember what the answer was. Have we ever held a Republican primary while a candidate's been in office before? I mean, while there's been an incumbent not in office?
We did, but it was back in the 80s, I think.
Yeah,
right?
George Bush faced
David Duke
and Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan, that was the one. I was like, I could see P and B in my head, but I haven't had breakfast, so peanut butter is not the answer.
So why did the party okay it back then?
I think there was just kind of a general dissatisfaction with Bush at the time, and the process took off from there. And I think Buchanan even won New Hampshire, so that he had some inertia came down here, and Bush won down here too. The party apparatus got behind him.
But Bush ultimately lost that election.
He did. He lost the general.
Right
now, the impact of the impeachment inquiry is really on the talking points. Right now, this is not so much in the ballot box. This is really playing out on cable networks and seeing, you know, Republicans like Lindsey Graham, who is up for reelection for his Senate seat, watching him navigate that is going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
But that's not presidential for him. That's a Senate seat.
I think it's also important to point out, too, that as of this date, there are 9 House Democrats that have not taken a position on impeachment, and Joe Cunningham, our Democrat here, is one of them. So that you might get a sway of that over the next coming weeks.
Yeah, I guess that's maybe one random question that I have is, I know that, so nationally, definitely it looks like, at least so far, GOP politicians have kind of either been enthusiastic, like the ones that support Trump really vocally have been supporting him, but it seems like a lot of the rest of them have kind of been trying to be as quiet as possible. Have we, what are we hearing in South Carolina? So far, do you think this has moved the needle at all, or no?
No way.
No.
Nancy Pelosi came and headlined a fundraiser, a Democratic fundraiser in Greenville, where she spoke. And outside, there was a counter protest from Republicans, which included GOP Chairman Drew McKissick yelling and screaming about Trump.
Yeah.
So they're very much they are standing by their man in this case. And Senators Graham and Scott have referred to it as hearsay.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're also calling on the Democrats to have an up or down vote early to get the thing going. So the talking points are the same among all the Republicans here.
Okay. All right.
It's going to be something to watch, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, I think that the one thing that I wish that we could do better as media is I also just wonder how this conversation is playing out around kitchen tables.
Yeah.
Right? Because we hear it a lot from the cable news, and we hear the talking points, and we see the politicians, and we watch them have to navigate their political hide and making sure that they can stay in office, or maybe they just throw caution to the wind and say, this is what I think should be done. But really, at the end of the day, voters have to decide what to do with this information.
Yeah.
And right now, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. That's a very, very, very salient point. I think this is a good point to wrap up this conversation.
So, so Skylar and Caitlin and our whole team at Host and Courier have been hosting these Pints and Politics events, which are kind of less formal venues for candidates to come. And it's not just our presidential candidates, but has been, we had Senator Tim Scott, and we had Congressman Joe Cunningham come to one, but it's a place where you can like just drink some beer and watch Skylar and Caitlin have conversations with these politicians. Over this last weekend, we had tons of folks coming in, and we probably have some more. I don't know if Caitlin, you want to talk about a little more how people can find out more information?
So I'm really happy to say that we now have a landing page for this where all of the information lives. Yes, we've been wanting this for a while. So you ready? It's postandcourier.com/pintsandpolitics, and the and is spelled out.
Andy.
So that's where you can see not only who's coming up, and we are reaching out actively not only to 2020 presidential candidates, but to other folks that we think people will want to hear from. And heck, if there is someone that you want us to invite who you think would be worthwhile and interesting, drop us a line, politics@postandcourier.com. But you can go to that website and you can see who's coming up. You can see stories that have come out of these events because sometimes, yes, candidates do open their mouths and make news and we are there and listening for it. And then you can also see past videos of events. So if you want to see what Mark Sanford said, if you want to see what Lindsey Graham or Tim Scott or Joe Cunningham, let's see, Amy Klobuchar, Tom Steyer, Michael Bennett, Tulsi Gabbard, and soon Marianne Williamson. If you want to see what they said, you can go see it for yourself. So we understand that not everybody can make it out to every event, but we do this as a service, and we feel very strongly about
that. And it's free.
It is free.
It is free.
It's that great, great price of free.
The beer is not.
You got to pay for your beer.
I don't even – I pay for my own beer, too.
And another way to really kind of keep in touch and follow the stuff of Caitlin and sometimes other folks on our political staff write a Palmetto Politics newsletter. Comes to inboxes 5 days a week. It's really, really well done. It's one of our most popular newsletters. You can sign up for that at postandcourier.com/newsletters. There's a box that says Palmetto Politics. You can also see it shows up on any of our article pages that are tagged politics.
Mm-hmm. So. And sign up for some other newsletters while you're there, too. Hurricane Wire is one of my favorites.
Yeah, so that's a good one.
I'm a big Hurricane Wire fan myself.
And finally, and I know people are probably getting sick of hearing this, but I think if you're really interested in politics in South Carolina, you have got to be a Post and Courier subscriber. We have got an amazing political team. We're all over the state. We're covering politics like crazy. So if you're interested in this stuff, you want to be reading our coverage, and the best way to be able to read all the coverage is to get a subscription and a support that helps support this coverage and make it all possible, make stuff like this possible. You know, like our newsletter, our podcasts are free. You know, be a subscriber.
Yeah, help support help us to, out. You know, if you haven't listened to our How the News Works episode, you'll understand that it's really essential for us to have subscribers in order for this whole you to have a watchdog still exist.
Mm-hmm. You guys make it all possible out there in listener land.
Thank you all for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and that's all. Understand South Carolina is a production of The Post and Courier in Charleston. Our producer today was Kristen Kornbluth. Our theme song is by Billy Fountain. You can stream his music by searching for Billy, that's with an I-E, Fountain, on Spotify. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can get in touch with us by emailing understandsc@postandcourier.com, or, of course, you can tweet at us with any questions or comments. And if you're a fan of the show, please take a second to like us and leave a rating on the Apple Podcast Store. See y'all later.